You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again David McElvaney. David is he's been with us two or three times at least on this show over the years. He is the president of the McElvaney Financial Companies, McElvaney Wealth Management, and ICA. That's a precious metals brokerage firm. David is a featured speaker on radio and around the country as he analyzes events, current events, and he has a very, very interesting weekly podcast that I highly recommend that you should listen to. It's very entertaining, and it's also very informative. He has a very impressive academic background, but he also has spent time in the financial world with the big guys, with the mainstream, Morgan Stanley. He worked there for a little while. But unlike most younger folks these days, he has avoided being trapped into a box of Keynesian orthodoxy, which is in the process of, I think, leading the United States and indeed the world down a path towards socialism and economic destruction. I remember David's father, his work as an advocate of honest money back in the 1980s, and I actually heard him speak one time in New York at a gold mining conference, perhaps in the mid-80s. David was handed the McElvaney business baton from his father, and he is running an admirable race, I would say, for the good of his family and for all those lives that he touches. While the McElvaney business has to do with investing and using gold to preserve wealth and other markets to try to help people preserve their wealth, he is anything but a hard-hearted, cutthroat Wall Street type. To the contrary, David lives by principles given to us by our transcendent creator, and it shows through when you get to know him. Now, most of us won't have a chance to meet up with David personally, although I believe he does speak at some conferences from time to time. But you can learn to know the heart and soul of David McElvaney, and I strongly suggest you should want to do so. You can learn to know David better by reading a book that he authored a couple of years back titled The Intentional Legacy. To give you an idea of what David is all about, let me just read a short excerpt from the introduction of his book, of that book. David says, every choice we make will shape the destiny of the children yet to be born. Every act of love or hatred, redemption or savagery, thoughtfulness or selfishness births a future for ourselves and others. We live lives permeated by legacy, the legacy given to us and the legacy we cultivate every waking moment of the day. We are the custodians of a generational story. Ours is one. Ours is but one chapter, positioned somewhere in the index of a book of indiscernible length. The narrative began long ago, before we were born. It continues further into the future than we might imagine. We may not do with our lives whatever we choose. There is a higher call. We are the trustee caretakers of our great-grandchildren's future. Well, there's much more in this book, but this will give you just a flavor of what David is about. I don't know too many Wall Street guys, Wall Street professionals who have done extremely well, as David has, who are that deep, who think in terms of the eternal and things that are much more important than themselves. So with that, thank you so much, David, for joining us again.
Oh, well, Jake, great to be with you. Appreciate your kind introduction.
Well, it is a heartfelt introduction. It is that book was an encouragement to me. I just really highly recommend it. And I guess they can pick up a copy through. Can they get it from your website, or where can they go to get it? Is it available in bookstores?
Probably the easiest place to get it is on Amazon.
Sure. Okay. So, David, I'd like to talk to you about the credit cycle a little bit today, and where you think we are in the credit cycle. Alistair McLeod is I don't know if you know Alistair, but he's a guest on this show from time to time, and he's talked about where he thinks we are in the credit cycle. You know, we see the rates rising now. At this point in time, banks are selling their treasuries to avoid losses. They forget about the losses that they experienced in the last downturn. So they start putting that money to work by making loans. Money actually gets into the real economy. Consumer prices and wages begin to rise. At some point, rising rates begin to weigh on stocks. We get a bear market develops in stocks, and the next recession occurs. And then the Fed comes to the rescue and starts another cycle again. Now, where do you think we are in this cycle? Do you think we're in the late stage of this current cycle that started after 2008, 2009?
Well, I think coming back to the Treasury market, you're talking about a cycle which is very long in the tooth. Luis Yamada, who's a technical analyst, was originally with Smith Barney and spent 20, 30 years before they shut down their entire technical department, did some great work on the Treasury markets back in 2001, 2002, and what they sketched out was that the shortest interest rate cycle in the United States was a 22-year cycle. The longest was about 36, and the average, you know, somewhere in between 27, 28 years on average. So we are here in an interest rate cycle that has started in 1982 in our 36th year, and we're matching the longest ever interest rate cycle. Arguably, we could have turned earlier had it not been for central bank intervention. And there's implications for that, of course, because as you begin to tinker with the cost of capital, that is interest rates, you do have an impact on real estate values, obviously bond values, and very importantly, interest rates are the most critical factor in valuing stocks. So if you want to raise the value of the stock market, create a wealth effect, this is what we've been experimenting with post 2008, 2009, is monetary policy on steroids, which has extended, I think, a secular treasury bull market longer than it should have gone. And that kind of means we don't have much left. We really don't have much left. But it also suggests that the tailwinds that we've had for real estate and equities may be lost here as well.
Yeah, it certainly has been a tailwind, that's for sure. So can there be another one? I mean, the 36-year Treasury bull. So, in other words, I think you've answered my question. You think this is probably about it for this bull market? I mean, I can remember Mrs. Taylor and I. Our first mortgage was a 17.5% mortgage in 1981 here in New York City. And we weren't allowed to prepay the thing. You know, I mean, they wouldn't allow us to prepay it for 4 years or something like that. Do you see, I mean, how is this thing going to play out, though, when this thing comes to an end? We have, right now, we've had David Stockman on this show to remind us that, you know, the Fed is taking out something like $600 billion. It's pulling money out of the system. And Trump is running a $1.2 trillion deficit next year. Is the answer higher rates in order to, you know, to meet this demand? And how much can this economy take in the way of higher rates? I mean, if we get a 4% rate, can the stock market take that? And what's going to happen to pension funds and a lot of other people that have their money and everything wrapped up in the stock market?
I think we're looking at one of the great epic battles in the history of finance, and it's unfolding right in front of us. It is the battle between centralized control and command and control dynamics and what we refer to as the free markets. And, you know, rates have been rising about 18 months, 16 to 18 months longer than the Treasury has been moving. So they not only started later, the Fed started later, but they're playing catch up and are very much behind the curve. To assume that the Fed is in charge here, that I think is a little bit like, I mean, if you remember The Wizard of Oz, he wanted people to believe that he was in control of everything. So, you know, he pulled the levers and there was lots of smoke and lots of flames. And the great and mighty Oz was actually a very small man standing behind a screen from, you know, he came from running a county fair in somewhere in Texas. No, I'm sorry, not Texas, Kansas. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's the impression that they need. The market is in control at this point. The question is, how much more will the central bank community begin to throw at the market in a real bare-knuckle fight? And I think we've already seen the groundwork laid for that. Some of the analytical framework and some of the intellectual work, which had to be done sort of at the ivory tower level, has already been done. We've had some experiments in Scandinavia where complete control of the economy, cashless society, and the ability to increase taxes at will on a completely captive audience, that has already been explored. So you're talking about Michael Woodford's work, Interest in Prices, and you're talking about Ken Rogoff and his suggestion of getting completely rid of cash because it's such a dirty, nasty thing. The reality is they need to be able to control the financial system and the banking system in order to assign losses. And that, again, this is where I think you're looking at an epic battle between the markets determining where rates should be and the powers that be trying to keep a lid on those rates, because frankly, we can't take it. We can't take it. $262 billion is the net interest margin today, or net interest on the national debt, I should say, from 196 8 years ago, and it's set to rise with a rise in rates. To the point where it's too large a percentage of our total tax take. A single line item that say 15 or 20% becomes a critical variable in sort of the stability of the U.S. dollar and the U.S. Treasury market, and I think we're marching towards that.
So let's think through this. How does this work out? If are you suggesting the cashless society that's definitely what they have in plan? They have planned for us. I think they also have bail-ins planned. The next time there's a financial crisis, it won't be bailouts. It will be bail-ins, so that they'll just simply take some of our some of the deposits that we have in the banks. They just take it away from us or give us capital, or give us stock or whatever in exchange for it. Is that your understanding of what they have planned? And then if that's the case, people will want to pull their money out of the banks. But if you can't pull it out and you have to leave it in digits, they've got you, right?
Well, that's right. I mean, so in the book, The Intentional Legacy, I'm talking about choices, and I'm talking about a curatorial work that relates to family dynamics, really. Mm-hmm. But at the core of that, it's still at the core of what I think needs to be as a part of our financial system, which is freedom of choice. You know, when you're talking about the value of agency and the value of autonomy and the value of privacy to make the decisions that you want to make because of your value system, these are the things that birth our future. These are the things that as individuals dignify us. Our choices allow us to demonstrate what our values are. Now, that is in direct opposition to sort of what we have today, a governmental leviathan that wants us to go along to get along. And you know, we've come to the end of being able to afford the size government that we have, but that does not mean the government has any intention of sort of shrinking itself. No. What they're doing in response is saying, away with autonomy, away with choice, away with agency. We have a one-size-fits-all solution, and if that means greater control in the financial markets, so be it. But you will choose option A, option B, and option C. That may be, again, U.S. Treasury option, a U.S. stock market option, and I don't know what option C will be, but I can guarantee you it's not going to be gold.
Mm-hmm. It's not going to be gold. Are they going to take our gold from us?
It's a good question. I mean, it's a real concern because there is a philosophical opposition. This is one of those things that has allowed for privacy, autonomy, choice, and agency through the decades and through the millennia, and it's allowed for wealth to be moved across borders. Not because that's nefarious or illegal or criminal, but if you look at the history of mankind, there is a lot of criminal activity that takes place in the halls of government, and individuals, if they don't want to be squashed by that criminality, sometimes have to step outside of their normal routines, which may include migration, which may include a whole host of things. Gold gives you real estate that you can put in your pocket. It gives you the ability to take a financial asset, which is completely outside of the financial system, and maintain your ability to choose and to do well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But again, police states are not, you know, what you're really talking about, David, is slavery, enslavement. It's an enslavement of the system that is in place right now. And so I guess now I would like to ask you, I know that you give a great deal of thought as to how you and your family and the people that you serve can protect themselves against what is inevitably coming our way. I know that the powers that be don't want people, are not shining the light on the dynamics that's happening and what's taking place. it's always, you know, people, we always have the cheerleaders on television to assure us that everything is okay. But you do a lot of work in that regard, and I would like to ask you about, on your website, you have a publication called Gold and the Third Wave, What You Need to Know. Talk to us about that, because, first of all, what do you mean by the third wave? And that implies a first and a second wave. Talk to us about the three waves. We're in the third wave, I gather, from your paper. And just talk to us about that report. And I think you indicated, well, I know it's available on your website because I saw it there. But talk to us about that report.
Well, I mean, one last note, because this struggle is not a new struggle in terms of the individual rights versus collective mandate. You go back to James Madison, and he said, since the civilization of mankind, I believe there are more instances of the abridgment of freedom of the people by gradual and silent encroachment of those in power than by violent and sudden usurpations. I mean, this is the story of all of history, and I think that's where we need to be aware of human nature and where power goes. As Acton used to say, Lord Acton, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. So the piece that you're talking about, Gold in the Third Wave, is a special report that we put together this year. You know, call it a look backwards and a look forwards. The base case is that we are an under-reserved country. Households are under-reserved. You look at the average household unable to handle even a $400 crisis without going into debt to do so. And you realize that, you know, close to 50% of the population in the United States is living either at the poverty level or at a level that doesn't even allow them to cover their basic needs. We can survive almost anything. We can thrive through almost any circumstances if we have adequate reserves. This applies relationally. I mean, if you go through a rough patch in your marriage, but you've made plenty of deposits to the love bank, guess what? There is an ability to endure because of the reserves. Now, if you're under-reserved and you go to a negative credit balance, this is the demise of many a relationship. I think the same is true of nations as well, where if you under-reserve, when you come to a particular crisis, whether it is an economic crisis or a political or a geopolitical crisis, it can be tragic and terminal, and it didn't have to be. So are we adequately reserved? That's a big question, and one that we deal with in gold in the third wave. Now, I look at gold and silver as the ultimate reserve assets because they do stand both inside the financial markets and outside the financial markets in a world that is permeated with layers upon layers of liabilities. I appreciate one asset that is not anyone's liability. So we see gold moving in three waves. We had the first wave of growth beginning in the early 2000s, and gold quietly began a bull market. It ran from the doldrums there in the 200s up to $1,930 an ounce, so about a 7.6-fold rise. And you know what happened in that time frame was actually both the first wave where it emerged and ultimately the second wave, where Wall Street began to take an interest. And this is very typical of any bull market. Any major bull market, whether it's Japanese equities or real estate or what have you, it's noted by mavericks who are first in, contrarians who see something that they believe to be true and are willing to put risk capital at risk. Then Wall Street, after seeing a price trend established, begins to take an interest and realize that they might be able to line their pockets if and when the general public ever comes into the same kind of thematic. So Wall Street creates its structures. What we had circa 2006 to 2009 was a mass proliferation of products, exchange-traded products, and you know, mining share, mutual funds. All of these proliferated. You went from just a handful, say a dozen or so, to having hundreds of choices. This is Wall Street's way of ultimately capturing the flows of capital coming from Main Street. Now, the third wave is when the general public begins to really get interested. And I think we were on the cusp of that back in 2011 and 2012. The gold markets were violently shut down. And I think basically we've been on hiatus in this period of time where a long-term secular trend in gold was paused. But none of the fundamental reasons that were driving the gold market circa 2000 to 2012 have gone away. In fact, they've all mushroomed out of control. You look, for example, at the emerging markets. In the last 8 years, since the global financial crisis, emerging market debt has gone from $5 trillion to $17 trillion. I mean, this is amazing when you consider that these are emerging markets. Many of them are borrowing in U.S. dollar terms, which immediately sets them up for catastrophic cross-border financial problems. Where do you see all of the defaults in the history of the bond market? It's when people are financing themselves in foreign currency terms, and ultimately the hurdle to repay those debts becomes too high, and they must default. So we have a ticking time bomb there. It's not as if $5 trillion was a trivial amount, but now we've added exponentially to that. Of course, we've nearly doubled our gross total debt here in the United States as well. All that to say, the fundamentals are still there, supportive of the market. What went away was an interest in gold because there was apparently no reason, circa 2012 and beyond, to have an insurance policy, to have something which was outside of the financial system. Faith was restored by the creativity of Mario Draghi and of Ben Bernanke and of Mr. Kuroda. So you had faith restored, which is why gold went on hiatus. I think you're looking at the emergence of the third wave, where we begin to see a certain degree of pessimism, a certain degree of skepticism and doubt about the veracity of the tools used and the effectiveness ultimately of jump-starting the global economy and putting it on a long-term sustainable trend. We've had 9 years of growth. I think it would be normal to see a correction in the stock market at this point, but underpinning that stock market correction is a very frail financial system. One of our colleagues, Doug Noland, points this out every week on his weekly blog. I would encourage anyone who's interested, you can go to our website and look at the Credit Bubble Bulletin. And, you know, again, the fragilities in the financial system are off the charts.
Yeah.
And I think ultimately you are talking about global demand for gold exploding. It's been consistent in China and India, and that has, throughout this period, has not changed at all. Europeans are moving back into the gold market. The surprise buyer of 2017, if you're looking at exchange-traded products, was the Europeans. And so the investment segment there in gold was very strong in Europe. And you say, well, why? Why would they be buying gold if all is healthy in the Eurozone? Well, Jay, you and I both know that all is not well in the Eurozone.
Yeah,
so add to this the consequences of tightening credit globally, and I think you have what is the perfect setup for gold going to $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 an ounce. That assumes a relatively stable dollar. You could see higher prices, of course, with an unstable currency environment, but I think $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 an ounce is where we go in gold's third wave. And if anyone's interested in that report, you can get it at goldthirdwave.com. There is a link there. You can request that special report, goldthirdwave.com.
And people can get on your mailing list to learn about the topics of your weekly podcast as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, and again, if you just wanted to go to goldthirdwave.com, that would be the easiest way to request the report. And if you additionally want to be added to our weekly commentary, where we've got some interesting guests periodically, and then the rest of the time you just have to put up with us. It's been a weekly labor of love for 10 years.
Absolutely it is. David, with 30 seconds, you do also have some sort of you have products that allow gold to be put into IRAs, right?
Yeah, we're actually the first company in the United States to put physical metals into IRAs going back to the mid to late 80s. And that is a very useful tool. We want to help people preserve assets. We want to help people think well and choose wisely.
All right. I hope our listeners will avail themselves to David's work, his team, Doug Noland there. I've known him for many years, back in the days with David Tice and the Prudent Bear Fund. Thank you so much, David, for being with us again. It's always a pleasure to have you, and all the best. Take care.
Jake. Great to be with
folks,
you again.
Thank you. Folks, that is all the time we have this week. Next week, John Rubino will be here. Michael Oliver will be back again. And Michael Adams of Northern Empire will be my guest next week. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Bonterra Resources, an advanced exploration company, is aggressively expanding its high-grade Gladiator gold deposit in Quebec, Canada. Over the last 12 months, Bonterra has raised over $60 million and has attracted strategic investors Eric Sprott, Kirkland Lake Gold, and New York-based Vanek Gold Fund. Bonterra is focused on updating its 43-101 resource in the second half of 2018 and will incorporate up to an additional 100,000 meters of drilling, where the dimensions of the Gladiator deposit have been expanded to date nearly 500%. Bonterra trades in Canada under the symbol BTR and in the U.S. under the symbol BONXF.
Auren Resources is a technically driven, capital-efficient exploration company focused on delivering shareholder value through accretive project acquisition and discovery. The company's management team has a record of success in the discovery, advancement, and monetization of exploration assets. Auren's focus is on advancing its seven premier gold exploration projects located in Canada and Peru. Auren's shares trade on the TSX in Canada and the NYSE American in the U.S. under the stock symbol AUG. For more information, please visit aurenresources.com.